if there was an African American family on a block, that block was lined in red on these maps. And that meant that that family was not eligible for a federally subsidized mortgage.
My interest in redlining in relation to the plight of the Black American today caused me to reach out to my former college roommate and dear friend, Laura L. Lovett. She authored the book, Conceiving the Future, which reveals the unacknowledged legacy of eugenics and a range of reforms regarding populism, irrigation, conservation, and housing, which indirectly or directly promoted selective reproduction. Professor Lovett gives a solid background on the origins of redlining in this country and helps to shed some light on a practice that perpetuates lack among certain communities, which directly affected the legacies of Black, Brown, and Red races in the United States. While the entire country is on lockdown, either self-quarantined or under curfew, I thought this would be a great opportunity to gain knowledge on the subject and the not-so-subtle repressing of Black Americans to this day. My crude defining of redlining? Redlining refers to an illegal practice in the mortgage industry in which lenders set less favorable rates to people based on their race. This is a term to which I am relatively new and look forward to gaining more understanding, its impetus, injustices, and more. I'm Kayleen Peoples, and I'd like to introduce Professor Laura L. Lovett, PhD and Associate Professor of the University of Pittsburgh State.
Before we get into this interview, I'd love to hear about your background and maybe what led you into writing Conceiving the Future.
I teach history, and because we knew each other in college, you know that I really thought that history was important. Actually, I started off in graduate school, I started studying writing and was going to be an English teacher. And while I was at UC San Diego, which is where I enrolled to get my master's degree, we had an incident in the cliffs above La Jolla twice in a row, separated by a month. There was a fraternity that burned a cross on the cliffs above La Jolla. And they were at UCSD, and they did that supposedly because the emblem of their fraternity was a cross with a flame on it. And so this was actually in the era when, I'm forgetting his name, but there was a member of the Ku Klux Klan who had been running for state council. And the people in San Diego were appalled. They couldn't understand how they could do this. Whether or not the members of the fraternity understood the ramifications of what they did, I was having conversations with students that I was teaching writing to who had no idea why burning a cross was a painful emblem in the United States and why it evoked this horrible racial history. There was a kind of level of racial ignorance that we may not have today. And I remember talking to my students, and these were some of the brightest students in California, right? Because they were at the University of California, San Diego. And they had absolutely no idea why people in San Diego objected to this cross burning and how it represented the emblem of the Ku Klux Klan, right? And white supremacy and racism and terror. And it was that moment that I realized I really wanted to teach history, that it didn't matter. I would always make sure my students could write. It didn't matter, but I was always going to make sure that they understood that no student of mine would ever get out of one of my classes and not have any understanding of why that emblem was an important one to recognize, to know the history of, and to never repeat. And so I shifted from literature to history and went up to Berkeley right at the moment the American Cultures Program was starting. It was the first time they used the phrase multiculturalism, and it was really seen as very radical that we were teaching history that would focus not just on one race, for example, but on multiple American races simultaneously. So that's a little bit about how I got into teaching history. And the more I researched, the more I realized that there were these things that we don't interrogate that profoundly affect our lives. And so Conceiving the Future, Pronatalism, Reproduction, and the Family in the United States was really an attempt to uncover that history of the way in which what was getting framed as the traditional America what gets referenced as kind of, you know, the great moment in America, really came out of a very complicated and complex history that we often don't know. And so that was where I began with that project.
Wow. So is that far back?
Is that too long? Sorry.
No. There's no time limit on this conversation.
Okay.
And this is a conversation because, you know, I wanted to interview you about this book because, first of all, I didn't know you wrote this book. And because I'm really interested in the whole process. What was the impetus of redlining? And once I discovered what that was, I'm a little bit late to the game. I have to admit, I really didn't know what redlining was till about maybe 10 years ago.
I think that's actually probably the case for most Americans. There was a book that came out in the early 1980s by Kenneth Jackson called The Crabgrounds Frontier that began to sort of talk about the impact of not just redlining, but the legacy of the way in which realtors were using redlined maps in terms of determining, you know, where to steer people to long past. There was a lawsuit in 1948 that basically declared redlining to be illegal. That practice continues long past. And that was what Kenneth Jackson discovered, was that realtors were using maps to steer people in terms of who could get what kind of resources.
I mean, I remember when I learned about it, I was outraged that, first of all, really? I mean, how evil, in my opinion, like when I saw who it actually affected. And I couldn't believe it had been something that was set in on purpose, but yet it was. And of course, my clumsy way of explaining it, this is why I want to talk to you, because I really want you to get deep. So first of all, tell me about Conceiving the Future first. Tell me about the book.
The book is really an attempt to unpack what we think of as the ideal American family, the normative family, and to really look at ways in which eugenic ideas at the turn of the century helped to shape what they called pronatalist policies designed to encourage what they considered to be the correct American population. And by that, they meant white, middle-class, native-born Americans to have larger families. They were responding to and beginning to codify the statistical studies that showed differential birth rates to be something they had to think about. And so the progressive reformers, they thought that they were creating a better future, right? Progressive reformers created policies that continued long after this era framed itself to affect our country. So it looks at American nostalgia for the fact that we imagine, for example, the Midwest as the model America, and we imagine kind of the rural farm family as kind of the default great America, and how that framed then kind of our development in the post-war era. So it really tries to take apart what we understood about those things. The 2008 crisis, right, is the predatory loan, the subprime crisis, right, comes out of redlining. Because the people who get targeted for the subprime predatory loans were the people who couldn't buy houses because of the federal subsidy. So redlining develops in the 30s. We're at this moment right now when we're looking at the kind of unemployment statistics coming out of this COVID crisis that were probably on par with the Great Depression. And one of the responses to the Great Depression was to then extend resources for the American people. And one of the issues, especially in the United States, was the issue of housing. And so you had the creation during the Great Depression of a program to subsidize mortgages for people that they really wanted to make sure were housed. And there was a real concern with especially white, working class and middle class families. And so you had the setup in 1934 of the Homeowners Loan Corporation, which was designed to really subsidize mortgages. There were seven people on that board. And what I was really interested in was not the six. There were six of them who were experts on housing, who were experts on labor, who were experts on unemployment. I was really interested in Averill Harriman, who was not an expert in housing. He was the son of the woman who created the Eugenics Record Office. And what I was really interested in was the way in which decisions that were made about how we were going to subsidize people who were going to get loans for their homes coincided with a plan put together earlier by the American Eugenics Society to encourage the reproduction of white working class or middle class native-born Americans. So redlining refers to the decision to go through neighborhoods in this country, every single neighborhood in the entire country, and to determine, based on the people who lived in that block, what the eligibility would be for a federally subsidized mortgage. Until really the impact of redlining, and we really see it after the Second World War, we often had a much more racially mixed neighborhoods. It didn't mean people lived in economically different places, but it was not unusual. I did some work in New England before I moved to Pittsburgh to establish what we thought was the oldest mixed race neighborhood in the country, historic site. And you could see there were actually very small workers' houses that were predominantly lived in by African Americans who often worked in the larger houses on the main street in Amherst, but they lived in fairly close proximity to one another. But what happened as a result of redlining and as a result of deciding that we're going to subsidize some people's mortgage, we radically segregate our entire country. And when we segregate our housing, we also segregate schooling. And because the U.S. pays for schooling by property taxes, we create a system that perpetuates inequity based on this categorization of who could buy a home and who could not with federal money. The redlining refers to these maps that identified four different kinds of neighborhoods. The best were either the green or the blue, and then yellow were often described in the redlining language as was interesting to me as a person who does the history of eugenics. The yellow neighborhoods were described as definitely declining, and there was a discussion of, and this is literally a word from the map, infiltration of lower grade populations. What that meant was immigrants, as opposed to the green, which was the first grade, the A level, that was called best homogeneous population of the American business and professional men. Blue was still desirable and had reached its peak. C, as I've said, was declining, and D was labeled as hazardous. If there was an African American family on a block, that block was lined in red on these maps. And that meant that that family was not eligible for a federally subsidized mortgage. What really happens as a result of this is that we shift in this country to thinking of homes as investments. 35 to 40% of the population owned their own homes. And they would go to a bank, they'd save up their money, and they would build or buy it. But it's really only with the creation of redlining that the federal government decides that they're going to give people a guarantee on their mortgage. And with that guarantee, we assure that the value of the property in certain neighborhoods continues to increase. And with the redlining, the value of properties that are redlined continues to decrease. Because even if you're a GI, for example, returning from the Second World War, you can't get a federal guaranteed loan for a property that's in a neighborhood that is lined in red. And so you begin to get the codification by the federal government of a practice that had emerged earlier where people had had racially restrictive covenants in housing that would say certain neighborhoods would agree to not sell a house to a person of color. And so I'm really interested in the legacy, and I think we're dealing with that today in the way in which people have access to healthcare, for example, to amenities, to resources, the kind of resources that people have that allow them to endure the kind of economic devastation that we're going through with COVID, really has this legacy based on this policy by the federal government.
I'm glad for the history because, you know, my information came off of Wikipedia, you know, and some other online sites. That's how I found out about it. Is it by any chance linked to the census? Is that why they want to know what everybody's breakdown is? You know what I'm talking about?
This is a modern innovation. This was created in the 30s. The census actually begins in the 1790s.
Okay, so that has nothing to do with...
Yeah.
Okay, I always wondered, I was like, why are they asking me what I am?
You know? Oh, you're talking about race. That definitely shifts almost every census, depending on how people identify. And in fact, one of the things that the language that they're using in these homeowner loan corporation maps, where they talk about homogeneous or lower grade populations, that reflects the attitudes about race in the 1930s. Redlining is made illegal in 1968. There's the Federal Fair Housing Administration bill. Makes it illegal to use redlining maps. But by 1968, because this had really started in the late 30s, 1938,
mm-hmm.
By 1968, there had been 30 years of neighborhoods that were lined in red declining in economic value and neighborhoods that were lined in blue or green increasing in economic value. And so what we know is generationally, people tended to pass on their wealth. If you bought a house in the 1960s, for example, late 50s and 60s, your parents probably helped you with the down payment. It's probable that your parents, because their house increased in value, could take a loan against their mortgage and afford to send you to college. So what happens then is you have this accrual of wealth, so much so that today African Americans have about 5% of the wealth of white Americans because of the legacy of people being able to pass on the increased value of their home and to use that guarantee of increased value to take further loans out or to pass on wealth to their children. Part of the reason I did this work, and in fact, it had been looked at by a law school to see if it opened up the case for reparations, because you could identify, you know, possible to identify two homeowners, one in a red line neighborhood, one in a green neighborhood, and you can actually mark the difference in wealth. Even if the houses started off at roughly the same amount, the difference in the mortgage that the Green Line neighborhood owner could pay because of the federal subsidy for the mortgage versus the private mortgage that a person in a Red Line neighborhood would have to get and would pay a higher interest rate. And so it would take longer for them to actually own their home. And then when they tried to sell it, the next person to buy that home would say, well, if I buy that home, I can't get a federally guaranteed mortgage, so I'm not going to buy it. So they have to come down on the price of the home. So that becomes the legacy of wealth. We also know, even into the 1980s, that realtors would often use the maps that were drawn up in the 1930s to steer people toward houses and to basically de facto continue to segregate. The tragedy is that at the moment that we begin to repackage mortgages and to market them with subprime mortgages, the banks that decided to market subprime mortgages went back to those redlined maps and offered these predatory loans initially to people who lived in neighborhoods that were lined in red. And so if you took one of those loans, you had probably a balloon payment, right? So you would have a sort of a standard rate, and then all of a sudden it would increase. And if you hadn't been able to sell your house prior to that balloon moment, you were then massively in debt and it was repossessed.
Kind of like what happened in 2008.
That's exactly what happened in 2008. So they went back to the maps, and because by that time, you know, the American public believed that, you know, if you want to be secure, you become a homeowner. It's a very different way of thinking about how you want to live and where you want to live. I think of especially in Berlin, for example, where there are constraints on apartment housing and costs. There's a belief that, in fact, the government has a vested interest in having a range of people and a range of people with different incomes living together, that in fact you get a much healthier community than if you segregate by class and by race, which is what we do.
You know, it's hard. I'm listening to this, right? And being a person of color and growing up in a situation where we were middle class, I didn't even know these types of things even existed when I was growing up because I didn't see it where I grew up. But it's shocking and horrifying. And it's like, it just seems to me like the control, like you said, it's something that was set in motion because, again, the legacy of wealth is going to the people who are from those areas. It's going to perpetuate the same problem.
Right.
Which is what it's doing. And there's so much injustice there. The fact that it was even an issue then, our country has a lovely reputation of segregating, right?
Well, actually, part of the reason that happened, and this is what's original about my research, is that the American Eugenics Society begins to look at two things. They begin to look at the fact that right around the turn of the century, right, 1910s, 1920s, you have a decline in the rate of birth of educated white women. So educated white women begin to start to go to college. Initially, the first women's colleges are opened in the 1870s. By 1900, 1910, some of the wealthier families were sending their daughters to college. And when they go to college, they delay childbirth. Or sometimes they don't even get married or have children. They decide to have other kinds of lives. And so you begin to get this mapping of a demographic anxiety. In 1907, Theodore Roosevelt calls it race suicide, and he means the white race is not reproducing at the right rate to perpetuate itself. So it's the beginning of an anxiety about differential birth rates, declining birth rates among those people who are seen as the better class of people, right? And at the same time, because of the huge numbers of immigrants coming in from Southern and Eastern Europe around 1890 to 1910s. In the 1910s and 20s, you have the beginning of the Great Migration, with African Americans leaving the South for work opportunities in the North. And so you begin to get an anxiety about larger families among these poorer people and smaller families among these wealthier, whiter people. And so part of the vision behind for the Eugenics Society, and the reason I say this is that the Ellsworth Huntington, who was the president of the American Eugenics Society in the 1930s, creates a kind of plan. And he says what's happening is that we have this differential birth rate, and what we need to do is we need to find a way to encourage the right families to have larger families. They need to have an average of 4 children, because what he calls differential fecundity, right? In fact, whites are going to be outreproduced. And so they do studies and they decide that the reason that people are not having larger families is, this is in the 30s, is because of living situations. And so there's a push, and this is why I'm very interested in Avril Harriman as the person who's on that board. There's a push to subsidize homeownership for whites, right, as a way of encouraging them to have larger families. And in fact, if you remember, that the average size of the American family after the Second World War is 3.8 kids, right. The four-child norm.
Right.
And so they decide that what we need to do is we need to secure the way in which people feel about how they live for the right people, which will then kind of make sure that you always have a white majority. We're having the same kind of conversation now, and it almost feels almost exactly like the work I study in the 1910s and 1920s, in the eugenics era, right? When the Charlottesville protesters claimed, you know, you will not replace us, or they also often said Jews will not replace us. The us are the whites. Right. And the notion is, in fact, that you're having a kind of differential birth rate. So the anxiety that you begin to see, especially among white supremacists, of the increasing number of people who are coming into this country, and the differential, the multiplicity of peoples. Right. So the anxiety, for example, around the election, and if we have a mail-in ballot, has to do with the fact that, you know, in increasing places like Texas, the white Republican Party is no longer going to be in the majority. Right. And so there's the same kind of anxiety around differential birth rate that we saw in the eugenics era, returning in terms of these ways of framing how we're thinking about our policy. I was interested in how that framed the mortgage program.
It seems like I have an agenda with this conversation, but I really don't.
I'm sorry. I probably do.
Yeah, no. No, and I get it. You're very diplomatic in your explanations of it, even in the history, but it still reverberates the same type of shocking information. And as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, well, okay, so I get that. You know, you want to encourage families, and therefore you want to, quote unquote, help them out with their mortgages, make it more affordable, you know, white families, so that they can prosper and they can have children, so they don't basically breed themselves out of each other, pretty much. That's just a very crap mm-hmm. way of saying it. But I think about why, this is just a rhetorical question, because I can't imagine you would know the answer, but maybe you do. Why would the Black communities that are thriving get destroyed? There are certain Black communities, Rosewood, the Black Wall Street, yeah, Tulsa, all of the, you know. Why then, if the Black were creating their own communities in which they were doing well and they were thriving, why would those communities be destroyed like that? Like, it's like, isn't the idea for, okay, they're segregating. They're not, you know what I mean? They're not blending. They've actually got their own community in a spot. So, this is, I think, where I get confused, and I don't understand it. It's like it's just set for failure. The Black American is really set for failure. I was talking to an African, and she was telling me that she didn't understand what was really going on. She didn't quite understand why is it escalating in the way that it is. And I had to explain to her the Black experience. I'm going to call it the Negro experience, even though that's an outdated word. But I'm going to call it that because it's really the Black American experience. Because hers is not anything close to what we experience as Black Americans. And I'm not saying all of us experience it. But it is basically the majority of Blacks in this country who are basically discriminated against mm-hmm. and targeted and can't get a loan. You can't get ahead. It's very difficult for a lot of Black Americans to get ahead in this country. Mm-hmm. And
or even those who can get ahead, right? If you remember, Henry Louis Gates got almost arrested walking into his home.
Exactly. I have friends right now, Black men, melanated men who live in really nice areas, maybe have nice cars, have nice homes, but when they get into their car and they drive to their store up the street, they're going to get stopped every time or followed. I guess this conversation is leading into how we can fix the problem for Black Americans in this country, because it's really a problem. And it seems like when they try to get ahead, it feels like there's still hidden slavery going on, even though technically we're not in shackles, but we're the number one incarcerated in this country. You know what I'm saying? Highest homeless. What do you think about that?
I'm a historian, and I look to the past, right? And I'm writing a biography right now of Dorothy Pittman Hughes, and I look at the way in which her securing funding from the Office of Economic Opportunity in 1965, part of the War on Poverty that Lyndon Johnson launched, allowed her to get community development and to organize a community center in a very impoverished part of what was then the Upper West Side of New York. You know, I think that there are moments when you create programs in the same way that the Homeowners Loan Corporation, the thing that came out of it was that you changed the white American working class, right? So all of a sudden, not only owning homes, but making sure that your kids could go to college, which was something that had not ever happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you changed a population and their opportunity. And there were moments like that. The OEO, the War on Poverty, that was ended under Nixon, but really kind of created a vision of empowerment for people, right? Where they felt like they had the opportunity and the right to insist on equity. And so I've been sort of inspired in looking at programs that really did have these long-standing legacies in terms of the way that people imagined what they had the right to demand. And so, you know, I think we're at a moment where things have to change. People are in the streets right now because what we're living is unsustainable. But you have to imagine that things can be better to be furious enough to be out and in the streets.
Do you think that rioting, protesting, I won't say rioting really, I'll just say protesting. Protesting has always been the thing that started the actual change of a movement, right? And do you think that maybe we're on the precipice of it finally changing?
It has to change. We were at a moment, there were marches and riots in the 30s. The Great March on Washington is the way in which Franklin Delano Roosevelt got into office. Veterans who had been promised a bonus after the First World War, lost their farms, had nothing left, and they marched on Washington and set up an encampment in downtown D.C. because they had nowhere to go. And, you know, I think that if you think about kind of the legacy of what people insist on, Social Security and Medicare, the GI Bill, that changed the whole entire country, came out of protests in the 30s. It made for change.
Right. Even with Martin Luther King, the marches, change ensued. It came. A lot of people died. And right now, George Floyd, everybody's standing in solidarity on social media. And his face is the face of this movement right now. I'm hoping it leads to change. I'm hoping it leads to a point when my brother, who is a Black man in America, can go out and not be followed wherever he goes because he has a faith that has been socialized as intimidating because he's highly melanated, tall Black man. It's sad. It's sad that in this day and age where we're actually removing gender labels, that we can't remove race labels. I'm having issues with that one. Like, we're supposed to respect that somebody doesn't want to be where they identify with a gender. Don't even call them a gender, right? Why can't that spill over into don't even call us a race? Our race is American. That's what we are. We're all Americans. Why do we have to be broken down into our bloodlines? I would love to see that stop. I would love to see the little button on the census, what race are you, stop. I'd love to see on the applications, what race are you, be removed.
Because, you know, they do that in France, right? In France, it's actually illegal to mention race. But that doesn't end racism in France.
At least when you're applying for a job, you don't think you're going to be given the chance for an interview because of what box you've checked. You know what I'm saying? But here,
I see things getting better. I mean, the thing about these riots right now, they're protests, but they're also riotous protests, is that it's a mixed race group of people who are in the streets. The killing of George Floyd is so horrible. We're just not standing for it.
When I talk to people who don't relate, they're not getting it. It's always those people. Like, I hear those people out there. I have nothing to do with those people. That's what I'm hearing. It's like, okay, wow, they don't get it. And if someone doesn't know I'm listening, I'm going to hear how they really feel. It's still almost like a re-education needs to happen, mm-hmm. too. And I'm hoping that, you know, if we can force this change, they'll just have to learn to accept it. It's a very painful thing to watch. You can't sit back and do nothing.
We just had the anniversary of Kent State and Jackson State, which is another time when federal troops went in to a protest. And I think we were pretty divided in the late 60s and early 70s.
I feel like we've always been divided. That's the problem. I don't think it's ever really not been a divide. Obviously, I'm a publisher of a fashion magazine. But I've noticed that the standard of beauty is changing finally. They're finally embracing all types of beauty now. More blacks have graced the cover of Vogue, Vanity Fair, you know, the top magazines in this world than ever have in history. I'm really happy to see it. It's more accepting now. So I do see things in that regard getting better. And maybe this is finally something that is going to put a jolt in this country and drop the labels.
You know what I do for a living? I work with young people. And they give me so much hope.
Professor Levitt is currently writing a biography of the African-American activist Dorothy Pittman Hughes. With Her Fist Raised contextualizes Hughes's life within cross-cutting histories of children, race, women, social movements, and urban politics. The result is a biographical narrative that offers a history of the women's movement with children, race, and welfare right at its core. For more information on Professor Laura L. Levitt, visit pitt.edu. Music by the group People's Republic. The song, Rite of Passage, off of a new Rite of Passage CD, composed by me, Kayleen Peoples. We'll see you next time right here on Vera Magazine.